Is this enough amplification? Thank you. Thanks so much for having me here and for, you know, inviting me to do this. I should just say very briefly that I've known Eric for about, I think, at least 5 or 6 years now, and we met at a dinner for John Zurier here. And shortly after that, he came to my studio, I went to his studio, and that's how things start sometimes. And we've been doing that regularly and going to a great Thai place on like 103rd Street called Banklin, which I recommend to everyone. It's my favorite restaurant in New York. The other thing I wanted to mention is that in advance to this talk, we agreed on two things. One, we were going to wing it, and second, only one of us was going to wear a striped shirt. The thing that I departed from was I did homework.
Okay.
And so I wanted to start with two things I came across that are not necessarily right on the money in relation to this, but I think has a curious kind of relevance. One is a quote from Christian Bonfoy, who we just mentioned talking before, is talking about simply the frontality of painting, where he says, "This place capable of the most convivial as well as the most indifferent of welcomes." Christian Bonfoy is full of great malts like that about painting. And the other one is very different, which I actually got from reading The New Yorker. If I can find that in here. Well, maybe it'll turn up. I don't know where it went. So anyway, it was a quote from the director of Napoleon's art director, Ridley Scott, who also did Alien and the Philip Dick. So anyway, the art director's talking about what a all the things he likes, like webbing and rotting and sparkly things and things like that. And I thought it was really relevant to the work because there's a thing that you mentioned about how you thought there was a continuity between Romanticism and the present as opposed to being some kind of vast abyss that was modernism, which was a really interesting quote. And I was thinking about the work in relation to cinema because a thing I've been thinking for a long time about painting and modernism is very much has to do with photography. And often I would say that modernism, to make a huge sort of Greenbergian generalization, is that it has a generality of emphasis. Mm. And as photography has changed, because, you know, what happened when the photograph came along is for the first time there was an entire image all at once. So, of course, that was going to change painting. Mm. You know, it explains Manet and down the line. But now we're in this place in relation to photography where you change it as much as you do a painting. You know, there's incredible amounts of detail. And it's really, on some level, it's gone back to pre-19th century painting and earlier, where, you know, you go in and you look at details and things like that. So I thought about this work much more in relation to this kind of cinematic focusing of detail than this idea about generality of emphasis that I've had about painting for all this time. So those are my first remarks.
Okay. I mean, I think there's,
is this on?
Yes. Yeah? Okay, great. Well, I mean, something that's just notable about these paintings, I think you're picking up on, is the centrality of the form, right? As I think would And maybe that's like the glancing aspect of the photographic that you mean? Or the starkness?
All over. You know how for the longest time there was talk about painting was all over.
Yeah.
Greenberg is about all over.
Yes.
Impressionism is about all over.
Yeah.
And these are not all over.
Yeah. Yeah, they're very much they're very much about decisions and about and that's like the foregrounding of the form that I think comes back in the way that I'm using materials and material gestures like the webbing and the glitter. I mean, there's no glitter actually in these paintings, but talking about when you're talking about the cinematic effect of from the art director, the thingness and the things that are in the paint and the paint film and the collage and the surface that's accumulating in these paintings is happening simultaneously with a focus and that centrality of the paint. So you are relating to these bodily and imagistically at the same time, which would be different than how one is relating to photography right now, I guess, too. So photography, at one hand, would be you would have the materiality of the print and darkroom photography, I guess, and now we have perhaps a complete reversal of that, of the immateriality of that image, and these paintings are actually remarkably material.
Well, you know, that's the thing, is I was thinking about how you never had anything to do with photography.
No, I mean, I took some photographs of police officers once after college, but that was actually has like absolutely nothing to do with these paintings. But it did feel quite smart. I mean, there I had a studio up in Harlem, and there are all these guys in Hawaiian shirts by yellow cabs, and they all had a lot of muscles and gadgets and gizmos. I thought, oh, those are undercover cops.
So maybe that's where the gadgets and gizmos originated.
In the paintings?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But you know, before I did my homework, what I was thinking about is I wasn't paying attention to anything that had to do with it representing anything, but I was thinking about this is something I brought up with when I was interviewing Cynthia Carlson, is the idea of the negation. And there's this, the way I see it anyway, is that, you know, the only way you move forward is by negating an awful lot of painting or whatever else. And it seemed to me that this work on one level had to do with just a collection of painting tropes, you know, especially the texture that surrounds the central quasi image, you know, this pebbly stuff is actually something you see in, like, from, do you know that that beatnik painter, I forget his name now, you really lose names in situations like this.
Better you than me.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, you know, they would do these still lifes, and, you know, there'd be the trace of all the underpainting to the point where the texture would build up.
Yeah.
You see some of that in, like, around Lucian Freud's heads.
Yes.
And what you're doing is kind of like, instead of the integrity of, you know, building the thing up, you're just kind of like laying it on there.
But I think when you're talking about that, I'm just thinking about like kind of where I came from with painting, and a lot of the texture, the form, the colors, the space that these paintings are occupying was like kind of everything I learned not to do. So that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I mean, where I was coming from as a point of engagement with painting was originally a very detached, the all over form in that way, right? But trying to find a way that was maybe you know, it was not the abstract expressionist form. So where did I find access to painting was like Hantai. And it's what's really interesting, I think, is like in these paintings, perhaps it was like the Hantai before became Hantai, when he was like this kind of semi-surrealist Hantai. But I don't think these are very surrealist paintings. Actually, I don't like surrealist art generally. But, you know, that is what I wanted to do after school. I thought those were very cool paintings. I wanted to be a cool painter. I do not think these are cool paintings.
Well, that's the thing, is I think when you first came out of school, you were kind of like a lot of people right at that moment. You were like a Krebberite.
Yes, a recovering Krebberite.
Yeah, and then at some point it was like this idea of daring to put your heart on your sleeve and your work or something.
Yeah, but I think once you have that awareness of what's happening in painting, and the plane, you kind of have that that consideration does not go away. And then I think it just started to discover there was just a whole other range of engagements with painting that I just was not aware of. And then I remember that there was a word for it, which was, I'd seen your tableau show.
Right, right.
And I totally forgot about it.
You forgot about it?
I forgot about it. Not because of you, but I just forgot about it. And then I realized a lot of the way that I was sort of trying to discover or find, put words to what I felt was remaining about painting was actually what was being talked about and around with this idea of the tableau. And I think that is sort of what is staying here in the painting that keeps this as a generative process here to work.
We're in this culture where nobody paid attention to European painting for 50 years, so there's a lot of stuff to steal.
And it's great. I mean, yeah. Yeah. There is a lot of stuff to steal, yes.
Because nobody was...
Don't tell anyone.
Now they pay attention to it. I mean, nobody was giving you any entrance to that at all, you know.
Well, we have our little group chat, so...
Exactly. It's kind of a consciousness raising of European painting since the war group.
On SMS. With the WhatsApp. Yeah. So it's Ridley Scott.
Ridley Scott, but also Jean Fortier that Shirley brought, who I didn't even think of.
With these paintings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fortier and also Giacometti, as far as the fact that once again, the thing about the Europeans and the big problem and why everybody started paying attention to American paintings is they couldn't seem to break out of the frame. And the reason that I mentioned Giacometti and Fortier is because what they did instead was they kind of had this central image. So the borders just kind of dispersed. So it wasn't like they were sticking stuff inside of the frame, like if anybody read my recent review in Hyperallergic about French painters and being stuck in the frame, then there was a way around that. So, you know, you're borrowing a little bit from that, where, you know, there's this central image so that the borders, you know, as much as they're definite, they do kind of disperse.
What do you mean by that? Well, the dispersion of it. Because, I mean, I'm interested in the way, so there's, because there almost are two different sets of borders inside of these paintings, too.
Because of the lines.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually another way of beginning to disperse the border. It even takes away from the actual edge by the fact that you bracketed the image. To a certain extent, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the webbing or the lines, the ribbon, you know, they declare the surface, and then as you spend time looking at the painting, moving around and through it, you see that the paint has been built up around the edge to that material, so it actually so it loses its it shifts and so the diffusion, so I'm just trying to understand though, like the diffusion, do you mean in terms of how it's engaging in your perception or the physics of the painting?
All I'm really saying is that it doesn't depend on the borders the way a lot of paintings do.
Yeah.
And you know, you even kind of disperse the materiality as you get closer to the edge.
Yes.
But you know, before we talk about Georg Trakl, is it Trakl or Trakl?
Trakl.
Trakl.
Trakl, Peter?
Trakl.
Trakl. Trakl.
I'm going to stick to Georg. there is one element that also is very European, which I thought of when I saw there's a Carol Rama Louise Bourgeois show over at Fergus McCaffrey. And there's this one Carol Rama that is like so visceral. It's just like got all of this gunk really built up on the surface, you know? And it just occurred to me, I think she's Italian now.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, we don't do that over here.
We really
do avoid viscera until you go back to like, you know, what beatnik painting that never made it anywhere anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and once it made it, you know, once the American painting kind of moved along, we're just very puritanical. And I think that, you know, this element, I mean, we might go back for a little bit of history for the people that know about it, that first you were finding stuff on the street and using it as a kind of central motif in the work. And then more recently, you dedicated a show to Peter Balko?
Yeah.
Yeah, this 19th century Norwegian painter who had a kind of detachment to the mark, avant lettre, right? You know, who would make these big tropes that would stand for a mountain or the sky or the northern lights or something. That was just a swipe of a rag.
Yeah.
Very, you know, he's kind of being revived now, but he was ahead of the game. And then we move into Georg and this very interesting poem that the show is named after. By the way, when I was writing about Eric's work for the Balka show, I was trying to include Baudelaire's poem about a carcass he found on the street, but we won't go there right now. But you know, a few of the lines from the Georg Trakl poem is, first of all, this line that I think refers to the sculpture. Heaven celebrates sitting in bare branches, and then it's very detached, but also a little grisly at the same time. Beautiful as man and emerging from the dark, he marvels as he moves his arms and legs, and his eyes quietly roll in purple cavities. Along black walls in the public place, a dead soldier calls for prayer. Lepers behold their image in dark water, or they lift their shit-stained clothing. That's my translation.
Yeah, that's not in the one I have.
Dung-soiled attire.
Dung, yeah.
So, the blue eyelids of the silent god sink upon him. So, yeah, this is the question, is this interest in, you know, decay.
Yeah, so just I think to flesh some of the background from where I'm coming from, with my work. It was like the first mature paintings that I felt were really mine were ones that I started making with found surfaces, found objects that had been crushed, so they had no dimensionality. They were flat, and there were things I was coming across and taking them and integrating them into a picture plane, gluing them on a painting and building paint around them so they would seem like, you know, an image. And my interest in was really that I felt that the painting needed to somehow justify itself through its existence. I didn't feel it was like appropriate enough somehow to make a definitive gesture on my own without having some realia or something from the world that I was pushing up against, so that it had a certain anonymity and a quality to it that able to, I felt like, justify its existence in a way. And as this was working, like, I was not actually, I don't think it was actually interested in the decay in and of itself. And yet a lot of the illusions that come back and the things that my work works around do reference decay. So when I go around the city, I mean, I think, as you picked out, I think actually in the Baudelaire poem, if we come back to it, you know, I mean, the smushed rat.
I was reading Treacle.
That's Treacle, yes. Yeah, right, right. But if the... If we do get to the Baudelaire poem later.
Oh, baby.
Yeah, yeah.
The, you know, we have like a, there's like a smushedness of the things that I, you know, come across in the city. That they're quite beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
And the paintings have a smushedness too.
At a turn in the path, a foul carcass on a gravel-strewn bed.
Yes, that's, and I see a lot of that. That's my daily existence.
Right, right, right.
And so, you know, if I think back before feeling like I had to justify something about making the painting by having some found surface, I mean, it's just quite odd when I think about it now. I mean, if I go back to more of what I was originally interested in, about making art, or art that I was excited about in high school, I mean, it actually was Giacometti and Fautrier and things like this. And, you know, I mean, this line, I think, in the paintings too, is even coming from Basquiat, of like the way he would cross words out so you read them more. I mean, I don't think of these illusions though now in the paintings, because I don't feel like I'm trying to articulate a certain sense of like existential ennui or something.
I wasn't even implying that.
But I do think that these painters, for better or worse, have a certain association around them that I'm trying to sort of dislodge a bit. Even Treacle in this way, I mean, a bit of, he's a, you know, every review you come across him or something about his work is like, blah, 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 poet maudit, blah, 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 he died of a drug overdose. It's like, okay, just look at the poem though a bit without this biography. I mean, it's just so boring.
You know, Rilke, what he said about that poem that you named the show after, is that all of the images seem kind of isolated from one another, even in the poem.
Yes.
These paintings kind of do that.
Yes.
They isolate this thing that's going on in there. But I wanted to go back to the thing that you said about, was it anonymity? Or
yes, yeah.
Which I think is really kind of important, because mm-hmm. they are anonymous in the sense that there's this, as much as there's a lot of paint on here and you're making all these choices, there's also this kind of passivity in relation to the execution. It's not, yeah. It's not energetic, but it's not energetic either. It's kind of, almost a capitulation to the materials.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's the thread that's picked up from those earlier found surface paintings that has persisted in here, and is also where a lot of their meaning is coming from, because they're painted, they're quite bold paintings, but they're not painted with much flourish, actually.
No flourish.
You know, it's just
flourish.
Like. You know, it's like here's this, because in the way we have this image, but they're also just like, here's a thing. It's a thing. They have a thingness to them, you know. That is the webbing. That is just kind of, you know, this frottage that happens when the brush is dragged across the painting. They're painted, you know, not like I'm thinking about it, just. You know, it's like the Purdy brushes from Home Depot, because they work quite well.
Well, they are very good brushes.
Those are very good brushes. You just leave them in a bucket for months. You don't have to wash them. It's great.
There's also more of a level of artifice than in the earlier work. I think there's more of a kind of contrast between, well, let's call it the figure for the time being, and the ground, even though... You know, when I was looking at one particular Balka image of that mountain, I think that's even reproduced in the text.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of, even though in the Balka, of course, it's representational, it kind of sticks up in there the same way that, say, Mount Saint-Victoire sticks up in the middle of some of those Cezannes. It's supposed to be a kind of disruption of the surface, even though it's an image.
Yes.
At the same time, you know. And I think that's really kind of important, how you don't allow this to be figure ground, and that you don't allow the paint to venture very far from its non-associativeness, you know. The color in particular.
The color, yeah. I mean, I think the language I've been... So, I mean, I really hesitated to talk about the forms in these paintings as humanoid or something like this, because they're not really, but they have... The visual language is definitely borrowing from many, many different sources, and has that bodily connection to the way you're relating to the painting. But it's not... They're obviously... They're not figurative, of course. They're not either like a hybrid figuration either. But it does point towards something I think you're talking about there, of the way the paint is orienting itself around the material inside of the work.
What do you think about somebody that's interested in looking at painting and comes in here and they don't really have a lot of, you know, sophistication with looking at painting?
I mean,
Is this for them too?
I think people would like a red painting. I mean, I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, it's kind of... I'm just sort of bringing it up in a general kind of way, because I was just reading about, you know, how the Salon began in the middle of the 18th century, and how all of a sudden there's this big room in the Louvre around... I think it's around 1740 or something like that. And all of a sudden, everybody was in there. It was the biggest thing to do in Paris. It was like going to Cinemax or something. And you got, like, you know, some fishmonger next to some aristocrat, and they're both, like, talking about how that landscape up top is really cool. And, you know, in some ways, especially going back to Ridley Scott again, about all the people that are going to be looking at that on their computer, you know, that painting is probably, this is just a speculation, but painting may begin to have more prominence in the fact that, you know, people, they're trying to fill museums and things like that. So maybe even something as esoteric as abstraction will just appeal to these this larger audience that seems to be evolving?
Well, speculatively too, maybe. What's interesting is there are more people who consider themselves artists too today than there ever have been. So I don't know. Yeah, I mean, well, to go back to, there's something in the Balke, or my excitement about Balke that relates to this. Okay, so, you know, this painter, Norwegian painter, Peter Balke, was, when he was working, there was a bit, there was like excitement and also like deep suspicion about how he was painting, right. You know, like, so people were, it was like, you know, because of the way he was working with material, Per Kirkeby called it, is like that, said that Balke used all these dirty tricks in his painting, and it's like, and it, I think that articulates that very well, what people were like suspicious about in Balke's painting. And I think that got me thinking a lot about well, what's the value judgment around that, and what does it mean to have something that's been like natural versus unnatural, or appropriate versus inappropriate in this way? A lot of the material that I'm using in this in these paintings now are things that I thought would be like off limits to serious artists. So the pumice, there's the shredded rubber, the glass, the you know, these actually don't have it, but you know, color changing paint, there's all that crap that Dick Blick sells. You're just like, what? Who the fuck buys this? Like, and I'm just like, I'm buying that, because I think it's that might be a point of access with that. So if someone comes in and they're excited about the work because it has that thing about it, I don't know. I mean, is someone watching? So someone watching, I have not seen the new Napoleon film, but, you know, well, when I watch Alien,
I think that what I am trying to say is that somebody can look at this the way they look at a film now.
Yeah.
Somebody can see, I think that I saw it first in sculpture before, but I'm starting to see it in painting now, the way that there's a lot of new sculpture that you don't look at the way you used to look at sculpture, but you watch it like you watch a film. It's very filmic. And I'm starting to see, like in your work, that same quality, you know, like you can watch it. Modernism, and I was talking to somebody about Picasso in particular, is that why I think one of the reasons I think he's kind of popular, and his, I'm probably the last person to ever realize that, but you kind of watch him improvise a picture right in front of you. You know, and that's kind of what goes on here, especially, you know, you kind of watch this painting being kind of put together, and you're not thinking too much about the artist, which is always like the kiss of death for me.
Yeah,
I always think of oh God, there's too much artist in this painting. You know? So
yes,
but anyway, the other thing I was going to talk about or ask you about a little bit is, you know, there's a kind of left wing and right wing in painting. And on one end is like it's completely valueless and anymore and completely corrupt, and we can do whatever the hell we want. It doesn't matter. Right? And on the other end is painting is good. People that make paintings are good people. And you'll be better. If everybody made a painting, they'd be better people.
Yes.
Painting is a good thing. It must be preserved. And I'm sort of in the middle.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's good.
I don't feel the least bit sanctimonious about it. I think that it has to be negated in a lot of ways to move forward.
Yeah.
But I also think that it's an interesting language with an interesting history that you can still work with.
So. Yeah.
I think you're in there, too, and that's why we talk.
Yeah.
But I think you moved from the totally ironic,
yes,
dismissive wing,
yes,
more towards the middle, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, I would. I think even the way that I was describing the engagement with the material from Blick, which I don't buy it at Blick, but that's the would help articulate that for me in that way. It's there in the material too. I mean, in the paintings.
But
right?
Then you found some. Actually, you found some new history. You weren't going over because Balkh is really new history.
Right? Yes.
And you found this thing that made him contemporary, which I thought was great. Really, a kind of conceptual leap. Between a couple of these dirty tricks. To the fact that I can use every acrylic trick that Golden has come up with in painting, you know. And the fact that you even were looking over your shoulder at serious painters that you could do that is curious.
I mean, when you were talking about the watching the paintings as opposed to looking at them, I mean. I was just wondering what you were thinking about in terms of experience. Like, how does that relate to the idea of like experiencing a painting or these paintings? Just because that's come up a couple of times. I'm interested in how what the difference is between we're spending time in front of these paintings versus the image and the way that the painting circulates as an image. I mean, the paintings here, I see it is very, very different than being online or some image like this, but it's not like they're like anti-technology or some sort of like Luddite. It's not, in terms of this left and right wing thing, it's not, they're not a turning away from the world, but maybe they do seem rather hermetic to someone just coming in off of the street. And yet I'm wondering if some of there's like a lot of satisfaction in the tactility of the paintings too. And maybe not so much my generation, whatever, but the one younger than it. I mean, if you read like popular news or something, New York Times, like, you know, 25-year-olds don't want to buy houses anymore. They want to go to New Zealand and ride camels. They want an experience. And I'm like wondering how that's related to knowledge. I mean, because when I think of experience and painting, I'm thinking more of like Dewey than riding camels.
Well, I mean, somewhere back there was a question for me.
But, yeah. What the question would be?
Way, it's a difference between a lot of contemporary painting, which is, big, I think, what they call performative.
Yeah.
Where it kind of like does a song and dance, and then it's kind of over with. And one of its traditional properties is that it, you know, after a few minutes, after 5 minutes or 10 minutes, there's more there than there was when you first started looking at it. But what I'm sort of parsing the difference here between the traditional temporal quality of the painting and watching it, which means that there is a performative element, but it's not one that is so easily accessible that you can consume it and be done with it. Mm. The way a lot of contemporary, essentially performative painting is. So, and also, all I really wanted to say, I think maybe we should open up to questions soon.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Is that they're just weird.
Well,
you know, they're very strange to, like, you don't really know what you're dealing with off the bat, which I think ultimately is the success of the work, is you have to position yourself in relation to them. It takes some time to do that. You know, because I don't think it's easy to know what you're dealing with, even if you've been looking at paintings for 40 years. It's kind of like, what is happening?
Well, one of the best comments to me I heard at the opening is like, there's there's a woman, she's not here today, but who works for a, they have a conservation studio. So that, you know, you break it, I fix it kind of deal. And I've been just asking her questions about how, what about art material for, you know, 10 years and trying to learn. And, you know, if you ever ask a conservator about like painting, they're very hesitant to kind of give you any sort of directed advice. You know, they don't want to tell you one thing or another, trying to, it's pretty interesting business, I think. And she just said, she said, no one has ever asked me these questions about making paintings than you. Oh, you have. Crazy. You're the only person who asks these questions. And I was like, okay, I mean, I guess I'm onto something then in that way. I mean, it just felt exciting to be kind of painting your way to Mars, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny when those things will be the spur, something like that's gonna, or it's gonna be the validation, you know.
Yeah,
I'm reminded in Fassbender's Beware the Holy Whore, where the director, he can't figure out what to do, and they can't get the movie going, and there's some kind of minor comment about the film being made in like some magazine that you buy in the supermarket, and that was the thing that got me, you know.
Yeah,
anyway,
well, thanks to Christine for all her painting advice.
Mm-hmm.
She, yeah, well, questions, comments. Tom's
got a question. Does he need a mic? All right, just belt it out, Tom.
Great cookie if you ask a good question.
Great conversation. To put it in like historical context too, like I think it was really interesting how you were both talking about, not necessarily in a positive influence, but like, or and also like European painting, how it's kind of, it's this place where you can steal. And the genealogy from like symbolism to surrealism to like this idea of like maybe 50s painting existentialism. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about that Nemeth film where Pollock is, he's got this like transparent thing and he's playing with these like glass beads and threads, and you're looking through it as an observer, so you're engaged in the process of creation, right? But it's very corny. I always thought it was like this incredibly corny film, probably because of that relationship to European painting, right? But there's something about these, for me, and I think the Giacometti reference is very relevant, that are existential, and that the crushedness is kind of like a pressure. It's, if you extrapolate that into like the psychological realm, it's like a psychological pressure, the crushedness in these paintings. So the fact that they're central, it's not so much iconic, it's like they are connected to the field, but it's like this crushed field. And then the parenthetical lines become almost like this rhetorical device that you're adding on to that, almost to say, this is not existential.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of like paradoxical things going on in the work. It seems like maybe, you know, just to, you know, put myself in your position, to contradict that kind of genealogy.
These are flatbed paintings, like, they're still flatbed paintings like Pollock too, right?
I mean, and they literally are made in that way.
But there is there's like this rhetorical contradiction, yes, to that history, kind of, in a way.
Yes.
To kind of turn it back to the materiality.
Yes. And I mean, I was just even thinking about, to go one more step behind that too. I mean, that was like a monk being criticized. Like there's always something just sort of rhetorical and central and punches like a fist in a monk painting that I kind of can't really let go of either too. But the banding, yeah, it might be the same sense of that. This is something I found. I didn't make it, so you can't judge me too hard because I just found this thing. I didn't make it.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Can I just read my
Ridley Scott quote that I finally found? Scott's closest collaborators are trained to anticipate his aesthetic preferences. Arthur Max, the production designer, named a few. Smoke, thick, crusty, shiny, black, thick paint, heavy, aging, filth, dirt, textures of all kinds, shiny glass mirrors, chrome, metallic, silky fabrics, corrosion, small, fine, delicate mechanisms. He loves shadow. He's quite a hummingbird.
All right.
I thought that was quite relevant.
Are they dark paintings?
Well, what does the audience think? Are they dark paintings?
Yes or no?
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't really mind. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so I on my road over here, I was trying to get my wife to join me. And she goes, well, what do these paintings look like? You know, I was trying to think, well, I was just thinking to myself now, and I thought, you know, if I told her that, oh, they're kind of like a pigeon that's been run over by a car, and cut it, you know, she would have gone, no, I don't know. But I'll tell you what I told her. I said, you know, it's like when you see, have you ever seen a really beautiful bird when you go to the zoo or something, and you see this beautiful color, but then he's in a cinder block cage, you know, that's been made by Tapier or something. Yeah. That's what it was, that's what I told her. And then I also said, and it's also like a grotto, you know, a grotto where you've got rock, right? And then there's a little in sort of a cave thing, you put some miraculous stuff in there, like Jesus or something. And you sort of have this beautiful thing in the rock. Except instead of Jesus, you've got the horrendous image from Abu Ghraib prison with the guy cloaked up and hanging there, you know, in a tortured type of environment.
Yeah,
so that one. So that's what came out of my mouth, and I'm like, it's not as bad, it's not quite as bad as a pigeon smushed on the ground, but it's pretty dark, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, in a beautiful way, because I love the bird thing.
Yeah.
The beauty just to be put up against something. It can't be beautiful everywhere, you know what I mean?
Well, they're quite Catholic in this way, actually. Mm. I mean, with a big C.
Well, you know, I was talking to this friend of mine who's a painter the other night. He was complaining about a text written about him. And I said, the thing that these people don't understand about artists is they want to have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
And so the answer to their being dark is like, yes, they are, but no, they're not.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera.
You know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Yes.
Yeah. Hi.
At these from the perspective of contemporary indigeneity, what I see is very much a relationship to the land. And I haven't heard you speak to that, so that makes me assume that it's a subconscious more than anything. But all these elements that we're talking about, you know, the positive, the negative, the macabre, the beautiful, if you spend time on the land, those things are all earth.
Yeah.
Right? As are we.
Yeah.
So if you cut a body open, you may see something similar to elements that are in your painting.
Sure.
Right? But I feel like you've embraced all of those kind of dichotomies.
Yeah.
Even the organic with the line, I feel like, yes, it's like that abstraction that is present everywhere on the land. And then we have these sharp lines, which are also very present in, if you want to broaden the history of abstraction to include thousands of years of indigenous abstraction practice.
Yeah, sure.
That's a constant dichotomy, the geometric with the organic, right? Yeah. So it's almost like it's pulling you back in. Another person mentioned something similar in a different way. It's like pulling you back into, well, there's the intellect there with the line, right? But I wanted to ask you about the lines.
Yes.
Because I feel like, what is it, bias? It's like there's still this quote-unquote remnant of the found object.
Yeah.
That I'm not familiar with your earlier work, but you were leaning more into, but we still have, like, this piece of, I feel like there's a narrative to that line as well.
Oh. I don't, with all the found stuff that I was using, there was never an interest in the history of it narratively. It was really like the factor of the thing. And I think that these, the webbing is so anonymous in a way, even the ones that are printed that I've used, like they're just like a couple of stripes in a way, that I feel they're more about having some sort of like objective correlative than opposed to, I mean, you know, I didn't grow, I some history that I have with it in a way. Rather, you know, it really came out of, I was making a painting and I had glued some fabric in it. And I hated the shape, and I couldn't get rid of it. And it looked like something from Star Wars. Like, no, Star Trek. Like, it looked like the starship, the Voyager. And I hated it, and I couldn't see it. And I put paint over it. And then I just said, I need to cancel this somehow. And I had webbing from making crates. I mean, this is the stuff you used as handles and on strapping when you use a travel frame or something. And I was like, that would just make a great line. And so I cut it and glued it, boom, and done.
What I meant, right? It's like it's the sort of dissociative, intuitive narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the cinematic part. That's the cinematic part. Because basically, what we know from cinema is foamy gristle.
Yeah.
You know, this, that's one of the things the paintings kind of have on one level. It's full of like foamy gristle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they kind of remind me of like tanning a hide, like the stuff is.
But there's that level of artifice, so it's never like, you know, the real thing. Like, the paintings are telling you that it knows that you know that this is making reference more than embodying or representing or trying to, you know, have give you the sensation of.
But at the same time, there's this very overt playfulness. Well, again, paradoxically, overt and subtle playfulness that I feel like, in combination with what you're saying, it makes it like really immediate.
Do you mean with the tanning the hide was like, it's something that man is engaging with and adding to something that's natural to make it seem more natural? I didn't know
what just more to do with the tactility that
okay.
we see and experience
yeah.
in that process.
Another question.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask more about like the cinematic quality that keeps coming up, because I've been kind of reading that in two different ways. There's like the fabrication we've been talking about, and I think like you've been talking about the viscera and the construction of theatrical sets, and also I think when you brought up like Catholicism and like the Catholic image quality, there's like a very theatrical element to like the way that the image is situated in a space, and not quite like a glamour, but like an immersion that happens in cinematic universes that also makes them accessible to people in the same way that you were talking about, Joe, how like Picasso constructs the image and you can watch the construction happening and there's like an immediate visual clicking of like how that is happening. And because like there are art films that I think are still cinematic but not as accessible because you can't really perceive that construction happening. And so there's a fabrication and there's a performance. And I see both of those things happening, especially in the way you have these really dynamic, visceral kind of constructions and also images, like forms, as you've described, and then you contain them in almost like a scene to me. You even have like the panels of like a, like the frame of a film still. And so I was wondering if you had any more thoughts about the way that you might like see your work functioning as that kind of performance and that construction, or generally more about its relation to cinematic quality.
Well, I stuck you with the cinematic.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever thought of my work in those regards, but maybe, I mean, as a subject of this and being like in this culture, I mean, you've watched, I mean, it must have shaped some sort of sense of visuality. I don't know. I don't know. Why do you think, yeah, I mean,
But you don't
I think this photographics makes more sense than the cinematic to me, in that sense.
Do you perceive any theatricality in these?
I think they walk up to that edge and then push it back, like in the way that Tom was talking about, the way that the webbing or the stripes kind of undercut that a bit, and then is the rhetorical nature of it instead of it being ironic. I think that's what is a good way to talk about it. You know, I think maybe instead of being theatrical, it's almost like you need to up the ante every time in a way. Like when you do the magic trick needs to evolve a bit more to stay exciting for you as the magician or something. I don't know. That sounds like something someone said.
I guess you could wrap it up. You know, I would never say theatrical because I still go by the old Diderot rules about the tableau.
Yeah, yeah.
The tableau is not theatrical.
Yes.
That's the difference. The tableau is this thing that does not acknowledge the audience.
Yes.
So I would not say theatrical by any means. And, you know, this is why I'm sitting here, because I like this stuff that's not theatrical.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would... I think painting that I like always is rather quiet, even if it seems that it's using bright colors or a lot of tactility here. And that's why, I don't know, I'm not trying to like make a splash or something when I think about the word theatrical in that way. Even film I like is not theatrical, usually, so yeah, no, I don't think so.
Oh my God, more questions.
Yeah.
I guess we'll keep this going.
Thank you. I'm Barbara Rosenthal. I'm an artist, and I write for White Hot as well. There's a lot I would get into here, but I won't. I just have three quick questions with one-word answers.
Okay.
Was the person you were talking about Karen Yeager, the conservator?
No.
Okay. Could you please spell Mabalka? I'm completely unfamiliar.
So the last name is B-A-L-K-E. And the first name is Peter, P-E-D-E-R.
And the second may be, the third one may be more than one word, but quick. Of the group that's here, how many paintings do you produce, like within a year, or how many of this group come from?
All of these paintings were made this year. The sculptures were not. The white sculpture in the other room is from 2018. It was one of the first sculptures I made. And this black one was from about 3 or 4 years ago. And when I was working on this exhibition, the three medium-sized paintings were made in the spring and the beginning of summer. And I went away to Sweden for the summer and wasn't working in a studio and was working on a series of these watercolors. And when I came back in the end of summer, I felt like I didn't have an exhibition at all. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have any work, I felt like. And then I was going to throw a lot of them away, the watercolors I made, and Joe told me to put them in my bag and not take them out until I got back to New York, which was very good advice. And I took them out of my bag in September, and it's okay, that's going to be the show, actually. It's excellent. And it really helped me pull these three larger works together. So I made these three larger works since September, So September, October, beginning of November, which is rather fast.
Totality of the year for this show. They weren't.
I have no idea.
20, that you picked 10.
Oh, I mean, why? I wonder.
Well, I'm sort of interested in how many works someone has to do to produce the gorgeous ones, you know.
There's no studies that I'm making for these paintings. I mean, I don't know. They just kind of, they come or they go. I'm not sure. What I'm actually more interested in is like, is the, there's a belief system behind what you're actually communicating, I think.
Yeah, well, I asked a similar question to Ross Blechner, and he explained how he kept, you know, scraping off and off and off, you know, until he got what he wanted.
You know, I mean, a lot of times in the studio is more, it's more what I'm not doing than what I'm doing is the important thing, I think. So everyone's supposed to make 20 paintings a year, right? That's what I do. Yeah.
Working on each piece until you feel like it's done, or
yeah. Yeah, I mean, they most, I try to, yeah, get that going, yeah. And sometimes they go away for a couple of months and come back, but yeah.
They don't go away.
No. Yeah.
So, we all have multiple associations, obviously, to any abstraction. But as I listened to the whole discussion, which I think it's been really, really interesting, I keep thinking two things. One is that they're map-like and landscape-like on the one hand, and then they're, because of the positioning, they're wounds. They're like wounds in the canvas. Mm. So you're like looking through into something else. And you know, I'm certainly a big admirer of schmutz and, you know, crumpled stuff and gooey and flowy and, you know, I like netting a lot. Yeah. But I feel like when you talk about that history, Joe, in relation to painting, I mean, I do think that a lot of women in their work since the 60s, and maybe even earlier in the 20th century, have explored viscera in various ways, including in painting and in sculpture, that, you know, it's like, it's been a territory that's, you know, hasn't been sanctioned by Greenberg and, you know, whomever. So that's been an area for exploration. Mm. So I don't think it's correct to say that schmutz is, you know, only the Germans like it, you know. But I'm also interested in the difference between the sculptures and the paintings because, I mean, I'm sitting here looking at this painting for a long time now, and I, you know, it just, from the minute I sat down, it was like, this painting is just jumping off the wall for me, you know, like, why didn't you make that into a sculpture? And but yet I see with your sculptures, and I'm sorry, I haven't looked at the whole show closely yet, but I see that the sculpture is really not much like that. Doesn't have that wound-like, you know, visceral. I mean, it's visceral enough for sure, but not in the same way as the paintings are.
Yeah, I think the sculptures, because they're in space, are more contained. So when I'm, the sculptures in the same way as the paintings do expand, but where you're actually seeing the... You see the physical space of the paintings more literally where it has been edited, and you're not seeing that, you're feeling that more in the sculptures. So the sculptures, they do grow quite a bit, but you can see like where there's those two little apertures on the left side of that sculpture. I mean, it extended a bit more, and I chopped it up, and I sealed that up and painted it.
But in
more.
Terms of color, no. Real relationship to putting color in the sculptures.
Well, because they're forms and the light is working around it, I don't think that the colors would help articulate the drawing element of the sculptures. So the color, these paintings are not monochromatic, even though they're in a monochromatic field often, and the sculptures would, I don't know, I mean, I feel like it would be just as, I think that sculpture would, but I don't know, I mean, I think it would work just as well, orange as black. I mean, it could be, could, I don't know, I haven't thought about it that much. Stay tuned. It would be, come back in 3 years.
It would be very different in orange.
Yeah. I don't, yeah.
I think so. Huh?
Well, we'll see. I'll have to do some experiments.
Mm. Well, the kind of sculpture is almost like you can imagine the sculpture being pulled out of the center of these paintings. They're very
similar. Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
I think so.
Perimeter. Anyway, I've run out of vocabulary personally. So.
That's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
All very much.
Thank you all for coming.